Welcome to The Stories That Make Us, a podcast about the fiction that has molded, shaped, and inspired us. I'm Rory Doherty, and this is my co-host, Abby Ruggles.
Hiya.
Each episode, we chat to a different creative and explore which narratives have impacted them the most. This week, our guest is Daryl Baxter, who is the acting editor of Stealth Optional, an author and podcaster. How are you doing, Daryl?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. And Abby, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm wonderful. We're doing very individual questions this week. I'm not going to ask people generally how
they're doing. Not allowed to talk to each other.
No, no. I don't want any conferring, basically. Has everyone's week, month, existence been?
I don't even know what day it is anymore.
So. Oh, same.
Wonderful. That's a good. That's good setting the tone for the episode, yeah. Though, guys. I think it's just a general sense of disassociation. Daryl, thanks for coming on.
It's all right.
Why don't you tell us about how you got into writing and all the different hats that you wear creatively?
Yeah, I'm going to try and make this as short as possible. It'll be a struggle. So I started writing back at uni, back in 2012, I think. When the student magazine, they kind of just did a massive email of anyone who fancies maybe sending an article, just send one in. And I thought, why not? Never written an article before. And of course, it was related to a game about Tomb Raider. And when it got printed in the magazine distributed around the campus, it was just kind of a, oh, well, okay. And then ever since then, I just kind of caught the bug. I didn't want to sound too Facebooky there, but that's what happened. And and ever since then, it's just kind of gone from there. So yeah, I've been attended events in LA. I've been doing podcasts. I've had one with David Hayter. And my roles have gone from freelance writer to well, acting editor as of today's recording. And yeah,
wonderful. And congratulations.
Thank you. And a book's in progress, which I've had to keep to myself for the part last year, but that's meant to be coming out end of this year.
That's very exciting. Oh,
look at this. You come on here and you wave around all your fancy projects.
Oh, it's weird to kind of say that I'm actually writing a book now after keeping it to myself for so long. It's been so difficult.
Yeah,
I would hate that.
I would be yelling it a lot at people. Wonderful. Well, of course, you're very welcome on. Let's dive into your picks. We've got a good mix across
such
mediums.
A good mix.
It's a really good mix, but they're very different, but they also respond to each other in weird ways, which is interesting. And if that isn't, you know, the most exciting thing you've ever heard, listeners, just just strap in, because this is going to be fucking crazy. Do we swear on this? I can't remember.
Yeah, we swear.
I swear every week. Every single episode.
I just mark them all as explicit because I just assume that one of us does it.
Yeah. Daryl, why don't you start us off? What is going to be the first piece you're going to be bringing to us?
Oh, I didn't think you'd be getting me to pick one of the three.
I will say absolutely no one has picked them in an order different to how they were submitted. I mean, this isn't pressure, but everyone's like, "Whoa, you have the freedom," and they're like, "Cool, I will go with this exact order." So you don't. It's not as stressful as making it out to be.
Well, you know what? I'll just start with the TV show, which is
Okay.
I'm gonna go for a curveball here. It's happening. It's happening.
That's your third choice. This is wild. Really mixing it up. If this was like a game show, that would like throw the odds completely, and I'd be
That'd
very.
That'd be it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Why don't you tell us about the TV show you've picked and give us a brief synopsis of it and how you first came to it?
Absolutely. So the show I've picked is the BBC TV show Life on Mars, which was first broadcast in 2006. So it was a show that lasted two series, also had a sequel series, Ashes to Ashes, but we were also in the midst of making a third one called Lazarus. And it involves the character Sam Tyler, who goes from 2006 to 1973. At the time, we don't know whether it's time travel or a coma or something else, but he's brought to this world where most of the rules don't apply. It's more like a TV show. He meets the team of Gene Hunt and everyone else and Annie, and he just tries to get home over the course of two series, and it's pretty much incredible, and it's one of my all-time favourite shows.
Now, this is, usually, we do, you know, a bit of research, have a wee look into stuff. Mm. I didn't for this because it is literally the next show that I'm going to be watching, which has just happened, like, so me and my mum for years have watched TV together, and we'll just, like, lockdown's been great for, like, just show after show after show. So yeah, that is the next one we've picked to have a watch of, and I'm very excited. And I know enough about it because I just read the sort of screenwriting book Into the Woods, which is by a BBC producer who produced Life on Mars. I think was executive producer on it. And he talks quite a lot about the kind of like how it works on a drama level, and which is really interesting. So it is, however, like over in like a day, because there's like 12 episodes of the whole show. How do you
have to spread them out?
Yeah, you have to, as BBC productions either are like have gone on for 5 decades or are like 3 episodes long.
Yeah.
How do you think that this show kind of uses its very short lifespan kind of for impact on you?
Oh, I think there's a few things. I mean, I think for one, the fact that they tried to get this show made like even 10 years before, and it was declined by so many different channels. I think the first one was Channel 4, and I think they referenced that in the series as well. And I think ever since then, they've just had been developing it for so much, and it just became this show full of depth and all these references and memories of all the writers, really, that they recall from the 70s. And to be honest, stuff from the future as well, because you even hear like Sam Tyler going on about Star Wars and PlayStation in 1973. it's nuts. But yeah, they always had a plan. And I think they recall, like when I interviewed one of the writers, Matthew Graham, last year, he said that they did have a plan for Series 3 and how they were going to like kind of peel back what it was going to be, but they held it back for Ashes to Ashes. So they knew where they were going with it. And I think because of that, they knew exactly what things to put in each episode and also kind of tease the audience as to where it couldn't have gone as well.
I mean, it's one of my all-time favourite TV shows, and I loved it so much that at uni I managed to find a way to write an essay about it for an actual module.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we did like a whole module on policing, so I was like, I'm going to get life from
that. Ah, very good.
Wow.
I can raise you one further of sneaking television shows into essays where they don't belong. I wrote, have I mentioned this before? I wrote an essay in my classics class, i.e. ancient Rome, on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh.
How?
I'll explain. We were meant to be writing on Roman comedy plays, and one of the questions that they gave you was like, why don't you compare them to modern comedies? And I was like, thank you for setting that up. I will now take this completely seriously. And I wrote about all the many similarities with It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Mm. And there are actually a lot of similarities. I got a really good mark on the essay. So there you go. Nice. Academia is a joke.
Daryl, when did you first watch Life on Mars? Did you watch it like as it came out originally?
Yes and no. So I kind of came into it like halfway through when it was the football hooliganism episode. I think it was series one. Yeah. And the thing that got me was when he kind of like solved the whole thing and it was great and people were going to see the match. And you just see Sam Tyler like walking down this alley and he kind of looks at someone and you realise that it's him as a kid.
Yeah.
And they look at each other. And the way that like John Sim, who plays Sam Tyler, goes from like joy to going in shock to going, oh crap, I've been enjoying this all, but actually I need to get home because this isn't real. Was what he thinks anyway. And just that switch from happiness to sadness to regret is incredible. And then you have Nina Simone like kind of playing I Wish I Knew How It Would Be to Be Free. That got me like straight away, because in that scene you knew exactly what the series was about, and even like kind of the heart of what the show was as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really emotional watch. It's dealing with so many things. What did you think about the kind of, I mean, it's quite heavily about kind of the social changes between the 70s and, well, 2000 and whatever it was, 2000s, when Sam was from. Is that something that attracted, like, you enjoyed about it as well? Because it's one of the main things for me that I like about it.
Yeah, is that. I mean, there's a few things, because I love writing about, like, say, nostalgia and retro games. And I think that's kind of like what brought it into it as well, the fact that I had a bit of time travel, because I love the time travel aspect of any show. And it's why Back to the Future is one of my all-time favourite films. But it's just they did it in a way that just kind of weirdly made sense, really. It wasn't just he goes back in time through a DeLorean to 1973. You know, it was an incredible kind of way of, I don't really want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but they just did a fantastic twist on it, but they did it in a way that it would just felt realistic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like it's one of those time travel things that they don't have to like overly explain it for it to work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how time travel should be dealt with, you know? I feel like it should all be there for, like, the sort of contrast as it is, as you have, like, I mean, Get Back to the Future is stuff amazing for that, of just, like, contrast between the 80s and the 50s, and it's like, how much mileage can we get out of this? I agree that, like, mechanics are really not as important unless they're kind of woven into the storytelling in terms of, like, tension and, like, ticking clock and stuff like that. Mm. But really it's about exploring those kind of things of nostalgia. And how do you feel about, then, talking about how this has impacted your writing? Mm. You're talking about nostalgia, Daryl. How do you think that you've explored the concept of nostalgia in your writing?
I think I've kind of, like, tackled it in the way that how people approach nostalgia in different ways, because it's not really like a happiness feeling that a lot of people feel towards nostalgia. A lot of it is regret, I found. A lot of it is sadness, yeah, or what could have been as well. So when I'm kind of, like, writing, even, like, weirdly about Pokemon right now, because, like, the nostalgia of, like, how people are going outside to play Pokemon Go, a lot of people can't right now. People kind of use that escape to play Pokemon Gold, for instance, to go outside and talk with people and things. But you can't really do that right now. No. That's also a throwback. That's weirdly a nostalgia to last year before the lockdown, if that makes any sense to you two. But
yeah.
I try and make that relate to everything, really, when I write about nostalgia and retro things.
That's really cool. I have to ask, as we're talking about life on Mars, is... did you enjoy Ashes to Ashes as well?
I did. So So obviously by the time Life on Mars ended, I mean, they already commissioned, like, the sequel, and I was really looking forward to it. And yeah, when it ended, it was incredible. The last episode is one of my all-time favorite episodes.
Yeah.
But even when I was talking to, like, Matthew Graham, like, last year, I mean, that first series of Ashes to Ashes wasn't the greatest. Because they kind of, like, really missed the point of what the show was about. They had, like, Chris and Ray, like, almost being like a Laurel and Hardy Chuckle Vision thing,
yeah,
series, which didn't make sense. But by the end, it kind of found its footing. But I do feel like Life on Mars had more heart into it than what Ashes to Ashes did, really.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, hang on. Ashes to Ashes is, like, longer than the original show.
Yeah.
Like, there's more episodes of it, the original.
Three series of Ashes to Ashes?
Yeah.
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 That's weird. That's wild. I don't know when that's happened before, that the spin-off gets more. I suppose when you've got the time travel elements, you have got, as in, like, you kind of have a closure to your series, which is just, like, abated of, like, and I feel like British television does this a lot, where there's a lot of succinctness to the writing. It's getting to the point. I mean, my favorite television shows are 3-4 series max, you know, like the all-time ones for me. And I kind of like that a lot of British television writing is very, like, what's the point of this? What's the point of that? Like, get to this point, condense it. I'm a big fan of condensing writing, you know, so we're not going over extraneous points. Mm. And I feel like with something like Likes of Mars, you've got the end goal, or you've got something that's driving every episode, and you can't really push that away too long.
Yeah.
Otherwise people go, well, hang on, we're never going to get to this, and that, you know, it just kind of has a more of a dead feeling. What do we know about this, the third series, and how are you feeling about it?
So it's a weird thing how this worked out last year. So Matthew Graham and Ashley Farrow are the ones who created the series, and Matthew Graham had kind of tweeted about having an idea for another adventure for Sam Tyler. So I just kind of randomly went and messaged him and going, do you fancy talking more about it? And then it was this surreal WhatsApp call where I just talked to him all about the series while he was filming The Spanish Princess, I think, for Amazon Prime. We just talked, like, last Feb. Mm. And yeah, eventually I kind of mentioned about what the show and what they had in mind. And they basically said that they feel like they finally found an idea for where Sam Tyler could go. And then when there was a live watch on Twitter, they both kind of tweeted, like, some hints towards it. So they called it Lazarus, which is David Bowie's last album name. They said it is involving Sam Tyler, but
oh god, I'm an idiot, they're all named after his album.
Yeah,
sorry. I'm just not very intelligent.
Sorry. And they said as well that it's going to be a show within a show called Sam Tyler Murder Division, I think, and it's going to involve everyone who starred in both series. So yeah,
wow.
I don't know how that's going to work. They said they're going to do it like an Avengers thing, but yeah.
That sounds at the same time ingenious and very stupid.
Yeah.
That seems to be grinding the... Matthew Graham's had a great wee career. Yeah. I mean, he's not dead. He's still obviously making stuff. But, like, I've just had scroll through. Is like a few he's like, all writers on Doctor Who have multiple episodes, they never have like a completely good streak. They always inevitably write something shit.
Yeah.
I feel so. He's done like, do you remember the one at the 2012 Olympics in the second series where the girl is like drawing people?
Oh yes.
Yeah, he did that one. But then he did the one in season 6, the two-parter with like the clones, the sort of clone people, which I thought was interesting enough.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He did like the first episode on that Philip K. Dick Channel 4 series, Electric Dreams, which, you know, I was like, oh, Philip K. Dick, and he seems to be working pretty regularly. So I'm glad that, oh, and he cut his teeth on Biker Grove and EastEnders, which is what everyone does. Everyone works on some kind of soap that's on for 19 years. Which is really interesting. Yeah, well, that's good. I'm definitely keen to check it out. I'm sure my mum will like it too. I will update it with my mum's thoughts on it. We like a good cop drama. I think our favourite's Line of Duty.
We'll do an episode with your mum.
Oh, that would literally... I've done a podcast episode with my mum before. So she's basically a pro at this point. Which is really great. Should we move on to the second one?
Can I just say like one more thing about this?
Oh, sorry, yeah. Please.
Cut out,
I'm saying that.
Oh, it's all right.
Hang on. I'll lead in this perfectly and no one will suspect. Hang on. Are there any last thoughts you've got, Daryl, about life on Mars?
You know what, Rory? There is one more thing. And...
Okay, right. That we can't use.
I'm just going to leave all this in. Don't worry.
Perfect. Carry on. Just go, Daryl. Just
right. It's basically, please avoid the USA adaptation of Life on Mars because it's terrible. Oh, God, the pilot is terrible. It ends. It's a 22 episode series and it gets cancelled.
No.
It actually ends on them landing on Mars. It's
no. What the hell are you? What are you talking about?
It's awful. It doesn't make any sense.
Oh,
who did they cast?
Who
did they cast as? Sam,
I've got a list here. Jason O'Mara, Michael Imperioli, Gretchen Mol, and Harvey Keitel. That is... Why would you go to Mars? I don't understand. Like, it's a... Do they know what a metaphor is? I don't understand. Oh, my God. Chris from The Sopranos is in it as well. That's great. Wonderful. Well, no, I won't watch that. I don't think you can convince me to watch any US remake outside of The Office. I really don't think.
The worst one is the IT Crowd.
That is pretty abysmal. Yeah. I was at a Star Trek convention once, because these are things I do and tell people. And there's someone from Deep Space Nine whose name escapes me, but who plays Jadzia Dax. And she was on the Red Dwarf American pilot, which was just a pilot. And they kind of asked her about it, and she was like, yeah, I had a great time. We kind of knew it was utter garbage, but we didn't. Yeah, this definitely is not going to get picked up. And I think feel like I know the Inbetweeners American series is also notoriously bad. But
I
what
mean,
a lot
so
of people.
British. Like,
yeah, I know.
Yeah.
What a lot of people don't realize is that it was directed by Taika Waititi.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, look it up. Episodes directed by Taika Waititi, which is fantastic. Okay. And has everyone said anything? Have they said everything out of the way? Is there anything anyone wants to say? Good.
I'm good.
All right.
Moving on then, Daryl, what piece would you like to talk about next? Can I say, I don't like that you actually are exercising your power to list these off out of order. It kind of unsettles the steady calm that we kind of operate over here. I don't want anyone, any future guests, to get the idea that you can just come on and be anarchists here.
Just stop asking people.
Yeah, it's a good. No, we need to give the impression that this is not controlled space. But just to let you know, Daryl will be having a stern talking to him after this.
Oh no!
What would you like for your second piece?
Well, you know what? I think this is the second one I put. So I'll say it as Tomb Raider 2.
Perfect. Yes. Good.
Great. Good. Very good. Right.
Good. Look, tick box. Cross off decapitation from my list of things to do.
For you. Avoided.
This is a little video game which you can play with your computers. And
yes. Yes, it is.
Why don't you tell me about Tomb Raider 2 and how this sequel kind of branched from the original and what impact it had on you?
Okay, so this was one of the games like back in the late 90s that kind of really made me think that games were just something other than like a movie or a TV show or something. That Metal Gear Solid and Sonic were really the three things that kind of made me think that, yeah, this could be really just amazing, rather than going from point A to point B. And I think what it was about Tomb Raider 2 and not the other ones was the fact that it had this kind of James Bondian effect that the other ones really didn't have, and also like kind of like a like a cheekiness as well to it. It wasn't too serious, like the reboot kind of treats itself as I feel. And you've got like things like, say, like driving this speedboat through Venice, through mines for no reason at all, or an opera house, or, you know, going to an oil rig for no reason at all. And even with a 32-bit system like the PlayStation, you feel like, especially in the water levels, like 40 fathoms, you're in this wide ocean where you don't know where to go. But it just makes you kind of have that Pringle effect of like, just one more go, just keep it going. And it was actually the article that I sent to the student magazine that involved Tomb Raider 2. So it was like a one-page thing of that game. And yeah, it's amazing because, oddly enough, like the game has kind of like surfed this writing career of mine, because I've been able to interview like the original composer, a couple of the designers for an article a few years ago. And it's weirdly kind of like defined some of the articles that I've been writing about the last few years. But I'll go back to it every year or so because I just find it such a fun game.
I mean, the impact that Tomb Raider has had on video games is kind of monumental, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
100%. Why don't you explain it to me? Why don't you explain the impact that it had? Because I don't know.
So I think one of the things was the fact that you've played as a female protagonist this time. I mean, it wasn't male, really. And there was personality as well. And it was a fact as well that it was a game where you had almost some kind of freedom in each level, even the training level. Because even now, you go on TikTok or Facebook, the meme that you will see about Tomb Raider is locking the butler in the freezer. It's the one thing that you will see repeatedly, and this game introduced it. So a lot of it is kind of like in jokes and the fun of it. And I think a lot of it is just during that time as well, of like Britpop and Spice Girls and things like that, and Live and Kicking and SMTV Live, everything. And that kind of brought into that late 90s mindset. And Tomb Raider, I feel like, was a big part of it. And I think ever since then, it's been in mostly every gamer's consciousness. And I think regardless of how it's turned out with the reboot and things, and especially on its anniversary this year, I kind of feel like it's one of those franchises that will never go away, as big as Mario, Sonic, or anything else.
Well, I wonder what they're... I mean, you guys can... I'm living in a box. Has this new... I remember the impact the gritty one had. I remember that coming out and that being a big thing, and then obviously making the movie and stuff. I mean, have they run that out, or are they just continuing that until it like stops, you know, selling copies? Like, where are they going to go next with this? Do you think they're maybe return to the sort of original ones because everyone likes the kind of old nostalgia of this?
Yeah, I think they will, because they did announce at the beginning of this Tomb Raider 25 anniversary celebrations that they were trying to merge the timelines of the original Core Design games and Crystal Dynamic games into one. So, yeah, so they say they don't have anything to announce for a new game this year, but I feel like... I don't know, actually. But I don't know how they're going to play it, because they can't really do like a multiverse, like almost a WandaVision kind of two Laras at once or something. I don't know how they're going to do
multiverse.
It. like Shelley Blonde voicing Lara and Camilla Lovington with another. I don't know, but I'm interested to see how they go. But yeah, I really don't know how they'll play that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the reception of the last two being good, but I think they realize that this is more of a gimmick than a earnest start on a new way of doing that, because as you say, you have this sort of James Bond style that's coming to the original ones. You can get away with doing adventure after adventure after adventure, but if you root it in like a gritty survival, this character has to learn so much of course this source of time, you can't really do the same. But listen, I could spend hours just listening to 90s early 2000 video game voice acting, because it is just a real special time. And you've noted that the voicing stood out to you in this game. Why don't you tell me about that?
Yeah, so the thing is, in the 90s, like, it was like the decade where there wasn't any Doctor Who. So any decade before and after, like, anyone who kind of grew up in that era, you kind of like have an early memory of watching Doctor Who. And I didn't. And mine was kind of like playing the games of different things, whether that was Resident Evil or Tomb Raider or something else. And that was my, you know, my childhood. That's what I remember. And with Tomb Raider, I mean, obviously had Shelley Blonde in the first game, he had Judith Gibbons in the second and third, and then so on and so on. So I always kind of like, it was kind of my kind of Doctor Who in a sense, if that made any sense at all, because yeah. You've got different personalities, Lara Croft, for different interpretations, like Doctor Who, like James Bond. And that kind of really rang true for me, and especially the music as well. I mean, you got Nathan McCree's like Venice violins music, or the Skidoo when you go on the speeder in Tibet. And it's great, it's amazing. But you got that music, that 90s music, and that's really kind of like what makes an impact for me. It's that music and the style and the ambiance. It just makes it just an incredible game for me.
The music can really like completely change the atmosphere in a game, and a good soundtrack is just the perfect thing to come back to if you don't actually want to play something.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that kind of comes into my question, and I should have asked this when we talked about Silent Hill 2. How recently have you played this, and does it hold up, and where do you think this kind of conversation about old games holding up in games criticism kind of currently sits?
Oh, that is a good question.
Thank you. I like to ask good questions.
You do, it's good, it's going well.
Keep that in, Abby.
So last time I played the second one was, I believe, September, because getting the old games to work on modern PCs, it's a ball ache. It really is. But the community are fantastic. They've been able to have it ported to recent systems now, so you can have it in 4K if you want on Tomb Raider 1. It's ridiculous.
But it works. There's like 9 pixels in that. How can you have that in 4K?
Upscale to 4K, you've got 16. It's incredible. Last time I played it was, September. And it was just, ridiculously good. But, it's a weird thing, actually, Crystal, because they're doing, like, this monthly thing with the series. So every single month from February till, I think, November, they're dedicating a month to a game. So the next month's going to be Tomb Raider 2 and so on and so on. But a lot of people want to see these games ported to new systems, because you can't play Tomb Raider 2 on the PS5. You can't really play Angel of Darkness on PC, to be honest, even if you can buy it on Steam. It's terrible to run. It's awful. It's you got to go to the command line and everything in there. Going back to about like rating, like say the games, but correct me if I'm going to go on a wrong tangent here, but I feel like you've got to review it in the sense of reviewing it when it was released in 97. You can't really kind of like turn like a blind eye and be, take like a snobby attitude to it, because I remember like reading IGN in the mid 2000s or other publications where they'll review remastered games but give it such a lower score, and I'm thinking, well, why? You know, you shouldn't really kind of rate it against Gears of War for some reason. I don't know why I'm saying Gears of War, but Gears of War. But you got to review it for who it was made for at the time and the audience, because we didn't have Xbox Live in 97. We didn't have hard drives for consoles in 97. We didn't have cloud in 97. Review it for that time. But I feel like otherwise, if, say, Tomb Raider 2 comes to the Switch, review it for the audience of 97, for that nostalgic audience, and people who want to rediscover what the older series was, how it was, for those who maybe possibly discovered it through Rise of a Tomb Raider, that'd be a great introduction. That'd be a great way to, you know, give a perspective in a review. Otherwise, I feel like you're kind of wasting the reader's time if you're kind of comparing it against Shadow of a Tomb Raider.
It's an interesting take, because I kind of think about, I mean, I think about that just because of, I did not grow up, you know, playing games. I don't play games now. All I engage video games with is just modern criticism of it. And I think it's a really interesting take, because I think it is disingenuous to say, well, it's really janky, and the poly count is really low, and that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, that, I mean, yeah, I mean, what is important is, yes, this idea of, like, this audience, you can't explain to someone what The Last of Us 2 is in 1996. You just, video game, like, technology and storytelling has, it's like that curve that just goes vertical. Like, the improvement over this amount of time is astronomical from like year to year. It's not like something with film where there's like they're recording on like the optimum like film, and you can watch a gorgeous movie from the 60s that still has all these really, really sort of like modern filmmaking techniques. I mean, I think what's important as well is not just like how would a 1997 audience enjoy this, but what lessons did this teach us that made an impact on the genre or the on the medium. Like, yeah. what impact can we see today from this game? And if you're not looking at it from that way, you're not really getting the point of the idea of a history of the sort of medium.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like, another point of this is, like, looking at the remakes, like Resident Evil 2 and 3 are a great example from the past couple of years, because, you know, they're kind of like almost cherry picking what works with the original games and they put it into the remake but in a different spin. And I find it really interesting, because the second game of a remake, I thought, nailed it, and it really kind of got into what was great about Resident Evil 2, whereas in my opinion, Resident Evil 3 remake was the total opposite. It missed the point of what made that original game great, because you didn't have a lot of the set pieces that made the original so good. So I think, like, say if Tomb Raider 2 was to get remade for modern systems, for example, I think then, you know, you'd be able to kind of say, well, how would the audience of 97 would have reacted to this remake, for instance, going through Venice on a PS5 and 4K. That's an interesting avenue to take down. But I feel like if you're comparing a game that's almost 25 years old and comparing it against Shadow or Last of Us or, I don't know, Super Meat Boy for no reason at all, then you're missing the point.
Kind of want to read that comparison.
Abby, why don't you tell us where you sit on this kind of argument with the idea of holding up or looking at games from the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm pretty much the same. Like, I just, there wouldn't be much point saying, like, oh, it's bad because the mechanics or the graphics or whatever are a bit off, because obviously something that was made in the 90s isn't going to look as good as the games coming out do. But I don't think that diminishes its importance in kind of video game culture or the fun that people had playing those games growing up, or the importance of Lara Croft as a female protagonist. Like, I mean, she's not perfect, but she was very much needed at the time that she came about.
Yeah. 100%.
How do you engage then with this idea of nostalgia, as we were sort of like talking about? Like, have you revisited games like this that you played as a kid and found it had a different take? Or now that you become a critic, you know, you engage with the games you played as a kid differently. Where do you kind of sit on that?
Yeah, so I reviewed like Resident Evil 3 Remake last year, and I remember playing the original Resident Evil 3, like back in 99. I rented it from Blockbuster, and it's one of my favourite all-time games. So me coming into that, I had to kind of like leave that side of my head of, I love the original game, I'm not going to say how this really measures up. I mean, well, in a sense I had to, in a sense, but that was like 10% of it really. I had to kind of measure it as a remake and how it reflected like the year of 2020 really. So yeah, it's, what was the question again? I've forgotten.
Yeah, just the idea of like nostalgia and like revisiting games as a critic, and how you found
right
different takes.
Yeah, I think it works both ways actually. So it's like, the more, I think it's any kind of hobby that you do or that turns into a career, like anything that you kind of do repeatedly, you kind of like learn new things or new ways to do it or judge it. And I think with nostalgia, and especially when you're in like kind of the writing career that we're all in, I think at the minute, like really a lot of people like take it really seriously that I've noticed, especially on Twitter, where they kind of value nostalgia as this be all and end all thing that they really value.
I think I heard used before, it's like weaponized, yeah, nostalgia. And it's, and yeah, it's, and we've now I won't mention which properties do this because I'm sworn under a contract to not yell about it, but we've now I think hit a critical mass where it's literally, here is the image you want, fans, and they go, yes, we like this is good. And it's just a direct call and response of primed images hitting that sort of nostalgia thing. And it's like, well, where's the transformative part of it? Where's the sort of like illuminating truths about our reality? And you know, I basically had to realize, thankfully there was no Blockbusters to get angry at last year, so I pretty much exclusively engaged with small movies, and I was like, oh, this is actually really refreshing. I'm just getting original content, like a really original kind of storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, even like say the Nintendo Direct, a lot of people were hoping for Zelda Wind Waker to be on the Switch or Twilight Princess. And, you know, there was a lot of pushback as to people like looking at Skyward Sword be for £50. Now, I agree on that. But again, you got to kind of realise, I mean, it's just a company. They've had to almost work with COVID as well. They probably haven't had time to have this all ready for an anniversary. And I think it's the same with Tomb Raider as well. I mean, you know, they're doing a celebration. I think it's great. Personally, I feel like they're relying too much on the cosplaying and the artwork of Tomb Raider right now. Because I feel like they really kind of like, should be talking to the development team, the original ones or the original voice actors. They haven't. I'm just seeing a lot of, well, I think earlier I saw like a crossword for some reason of Tomb Raider 1. And I feel like, well, you can honor the past, but I feel like you can't really be half-assed about it. Either do it the whole way or don't. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, if you need to really honor both fans, like how Tomb Raider is trying to be, like how Sonic had been as well, you've got to go all the way. Otherwise, you're going to miss the point and alienate both fans as well.
So when it comes to the reboot games, what's your feelings on them? Do you like them or do you feel like they're missing some of the kind of original Lara Croft Tomb Raider personality?
Yeah, I like the second game the most out of the three. I really kind of like that. And like the mini challenges and like the landscapes were just incredible. But I feel like it took itself too seriously, especially in the first game where she just felt like a damsel in distress all the time. And that's not why I see Lara Croft or any female protagonist as. I don't want to see that. I want to see people fighting back and just see like how they kind of like seeing it. How they go in these certain kinds of the world. And I just felt like it was just so serious. And that's not what Tomb Raider is about to me. To me, it's more about the comedic value. It's more about locking the butler in the freezer. It's more about shooting giant rats for some reason, you know, and that kind of British quip that Lara Croft had in the original games. That needs to come back, I feel. And I think if you had that, you'd be so far into like what Tomb Raider is about in the new series.
I mean, at the end of Tomb Raider 2, she literally fights a dragon. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Oh, yeah. That sounds my kind of shit. I will now exclusively play Tomb Raider games. Thank you very much. Have we anything else to say? I don't want to step over anyone. So is there anything else to say on Tomb Raider?
I just want to hope that they bring it to the Switch someday. But that's all for me.
That'd be lovely. That'd be lovely. Wonderful. Then we can move on to your third and final pick, which is the first of this medium, I think. This is the first, which is great. Very happy with this. Why don't you tell us what you picked?
Okay, so this is one of my all-time favorite albums, but my all-time favorite from David Bowie, which is Hunky Dory. Hit me with your questions.
You know, first of all, is I thought as I was doing like our notes and stuff for today, I was like, I'm going to put the album on because I haven't listened to it for a while. And like my day just suddenly was just so much better. It's such a good album.
Yeah.
I think it's got my favourite Bowie song on it. Changes. That and then Space Oddity, which was a couple years before. But yeah, it's banging. You just road trips or like car journeys with David Bowie always go so much better, I find. Like just stick Bowie on. We have a great one of like the greatest hits from the first few albums because there's so many songs. You can't do a greatest hits because there's just so many eras and songs and changes. But well, why don't you tell us a bit about the album, not the plot as it were, but sort of where it came in Bowie's career, how you first listened to it and the impact it had on you.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, this is mainly because of watching the show Life on Mars, because like especially like at the end of Life on Mars where he goes back to 2006 and he talks to his mum, and it's just this little sweet scene, but I don't know why, but it just gets me every time, where he just feels like so bored by this world. And he says that he just had a chat with a barman and just said that he felt like kind of alive and just having so much fun when he was back in that world. And then when Life on Mars plays on top of that building, it's almost kind of like a calling, like to just kind of go for it, you know, and then after that Changes plays, and he just kind of it's like everything's like just slotted into place, and he's home almost, and he's happy, and he's found his content in life, even though it's a coma induced world, but he still is. And for some reason, definitely around that time of 2007, I mean, it kind of really spoke home to me, because I was in sixth form a few years before that in school. I was like bullied a lot and things, and a lot of this kind of like the songs in this album really spoke to me, because I was in a moment where I was with people who I actually liked and people like me, and we were just getting on really well, and it was incredible, and I felt so happy around that time. And it kind of laid true with this album and the songs. But every single song, for some reason, I don't know why, it just, a lot of them just spoke to me, like Oh You Pretty Things or Kooks, where he just kind of says that line of I believe in you and things. And it just kind of keeps going on this upbeat rhythm every single track. And it just kind of makes you have this feeling of like, just kind of get up and go, and whatever pushback you have or rejection you have or no you have, regardless if that's in pitching or anything else, you just play any song from this and it just kind of puts you back to, yeah, I can do this. Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like a Facebook status there, guys, but that's how I feel.
No, of course. It's really good.
What's your relationship like with the other albums and different eras of his career?
Yeah, so there's a fair few which I kind of like relate to as well. I mean, obviously there's like, you know, where do I start? I mean, like Man Who Sold the World, for instance, Aladdin Insane, Let's Dance, or Black Star. I mean, there's so many that kind of ring true, like, to me. And I don't at the minute, but I used to collect a lot of vinyls, and one of the first ones was Hunky Dory, like an original. So just playing that and its original pressing was just something else, you know, with like headphones in. And like I say, the other albums I mentioned, I've got on vinyl as well. And just like listening to those, and like Gene Genie and Aladdin Sane and Heroes, just incredible. You know, it just kind of puts you into a world where you feel like nothing else really kind of can put you down and just keeps you going. It's ridiculous. I'm never usually this cheesy, but I just, that's how I feel about it.
No, for sure. I think it's very valid. Yeah, I mean, how do I know? I'm trying to work out how I was introduced to Bowie. I think it was just, it wasn't like always on, because there wasn't just a lot of music on my house, but my mom, I'm definitely, yeah, one of the biggest Bowie fans I know was my cousin Olivia, who we had on the past episode. I remember when, I think she mentioned, like, when Bowie died, she just cried for like 3 days. And I remember that was like my first thought when happened, where I was like, better check how Olivia's doing. I think she was in my house at the time. But yeah, Bowie was the first death in that horrible year where everyone died. I mean, I think people die like that every year, but I think we were just aware of it for some reason a bit more, because we were like, oh god, who's going to be next? And it was like him, Prince, and Alan Rickman within a month, and it was horrendous. But awful. Like, yeah, I mean, I will watch interview clips where David Bowie takes down MTV's racism like any day of the week. And he's just such a presence. He's probably one of the best celebrity appearances on the Ricky Gervais Show Extras, where he writes a song in the club about how he's like a pathetic little fat man. And it's
amazing.
Extras is very hit and miss, depending on like how involved the celebrity is. And the best episodes are the ones where it's like small UK celebrities who are in the full episode and are really up for like just ripping the piss out of themselves. So there's that, and and then the ones where it's like Ben Stiller or Samuel Jackson don't kind of hit home as much, but there's the David Bowie episode where it's just glorious. He's in a club and he's just like, who are you? Sorry, to him, they've managed to go over to the VIP area, and he explains who he is, and he just sort of like spins around and there's a keyboard there and he just starts playing a song. It's glorious. His acting career is also like brilliant, because I love Labyrinth a lot.
Yeah, it's one of my
because it's just like, I am David Bowie with this huge codpiece and a great costume, just surrounded by goblin puppets, and that's effectively like, he has whole scenes like the You Remind Me of a Babe song is like the best dance, magic dance, is like the best song ever. There's some glorious stuff in there where he's really creepy. It's great. And then I remember watching The Prestige. Every time I watch The Prestige, it's just like, he's coming. David Bowie's going to turn up as Nikola Tesla, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's a movie I have a lot of love for. Yeah, he's had like just a seismic impact on everything. You know what I mean? He's just in the consciousness so much. How much have you revisited him kind of after his death recently?
Oh, loads. I mean, I remember like back in my previous life, I used to work at a phone shop. O2 was one of the tech support, but they called it Gurus. So I got like the news like coming through like on my lunch break, and I was just in shock. And a mate who I worked with, Stephen, he just kind of saw like, and he was like, what's wrong? It's like, David Bowie's gone. It's like, what do you mean gone? It's like, he died. And then I was just like so low for the rest of the week, and just playing like all the vinyls and watching Life on Mars again. But ever since, I've just been, I think, just listening to even more, really. And like on Spotify, just like so much. I mean, even there was a small BBC radio show in January, I tweeted about it, where they just did a documentary on the Life on Mars song, which is my all-time favorite song. And just incredible just how they went into it, and the different connotations and interpretations and the covers as well. Just amazing. And it just makes like such an impact, because I just felt Life on Mars just Oh, I just feel like it's something else. It doesn't feel like it was made in this world.
Wonderful. Yeah, I like most people, I don't usually get into albums. Like, there's a few, I would say there's like 9 or 10 albums that I'm like, wow, an album. Like, this is it. This has impacted me in the way it was kind of intended. And this, I've listened through on it like this way. I'm usually like isolated songs guy. I mean, my favorite artists, I like a handful of songs from. I'm not a big music guy. But, yeah.
That's weird.
Is that...
No offense.
I am trying to just convince myself I don't have terrible music taste. My partner has like amazing music taste and is like a singer-songwriter, but like I just have really trash music. And it's like I have different, like if you saw some of the songs I listen to on repeat, it would be shameful. Like and I will never reveal it to anyone because I know there's no situation where it'll be like, oh no, that's okay, that's kind of cool. There's just no way. There's no way. So I have like my cool music taste where I only recommend songs to people if like they are like my best friends or these are like universally like good songs. But no, I'm not. But I mean, that said, I'm not like a Philistine. David Bowie's great. But I was never.
That's the main thing. Good.
Yeah, but there's something about like a design to an album which is really nice. I mean,
yeah, Daryl, I very much like don't understand how you can't listen to a whole album.
I don't know. Like... I don't understand how you can't like get off my fucking case. Like, but we all have these questions over our head. Like, Jesus Christ, Abby.
The other thing that annoys me is that people listen to albums on shuffle because
that doesn't make any
sense. An album was put together for a reason.
Yeah,
that doesn't make any sense. Like, if you're gonna listen to the album, don't just like ruin it and just go, well, I'll listen to the album but out of order. But no, yeah, I'm not a guy to sort of sit down with albums. I'm just, what's the good songs on it? I will listen to those. And if I really like it, I'll delve more into the albums and the kind of stuff. I don't even have Spotify Premium, though. Like, I get those sweet, sweet ads all the time. But I can have, like, unlimited skips through songs. Does anyone have anything else to say about David Bowie? Bowie. How is it? What is it pronounced?
Bowie.
Bowie?
I think.
Bowie. Bowie.
I hope so.
Hang on, I'll Google it. Is it pronounced... I've got a seen a flaw in my plan. Because you can't Google pronunciation. How do you pronounce it? His stage name is pronounced Bowie, like to rhyme with Joey. Bowie. Well, that was fascinating.
Very interesting.
That was really, fun facts with Rory.
That was fun fact with Rory, where you just hear the hammering of my Google search bar. Should we do a wrap up? Because I think we've kind of wonderful.
Why not?
Well, thank you for coming on, Daryl. It was really wonderful hearing your picks. Some great picks. I think we had some good discussions. I shouldn't be really saying we had good discussions. I was here. I'm like part of the podcast. If you thought there was good discussions, just let us know on Twitter. Say, yeah, it was some really good discussions, guys. So why don't you tell us where we can find you, what you're working on that's coming up, and where we can reach you.
Yeah, sure. So you can find me at the moment on stealthoptional.com, where I'm just kind of like pushing all the reviews and features and news there. I'm also working on my third series of Power Keys, which should be out in early March. And I've also got a bit of a Substack subscription that you can find on my Twitter. And of course, the book, which is in its editing phase, which hopefully should be out towards Christmas of this year.
Are we going to get an announcement about the topic soon, or...? Are you going to keep that secret?
Possibly, Abby. Possibly. I couldn't possibly say when.
But we've got an exclusive thing here. Wonderful.
Definitely soon.
What's your socials? Have you mentioned those? Or have I just...
Oh, it's pretty much just my name, just everywhere. Just Daryl Baxter, D-A-R-Y-L Baxter, everywhere. You'll probably find me.
Perfect.
We'll link it in the episode description as well.
Of course we'll link it in. Abby, what's up? What are you working on at the moment, and where can we find you?
I'm writing things, probably. I don't know. This is going to come out in a couple of weeks, so I don't know what I'm going to be doing then. But probably writing about a video game of some sort.
That's and you'll be able to find that on Twitter. Vague description.
Very ominous.
I don't know. Like, I don't have much lined up right now. Like, I've got one more review that I'm working on, and I'm probably going to be doing a small break, because I haven't really since like I started last
year.
For
sure. No, I mean, I get that. I'm the kind of the same where I'm just waiting to hear back. I got an actual rejection today that wasn't just unassumed rejection. Like, when you go, oh, well, they haven't replied in over a week, so I just assume they're rejected. So, you know, this is progress. And where can we find you?
Yeah, on Twitter, at Abby Ruggles.
Perfect. And I'm just typing things and on a computer. You can find me at Rory Has Opinions. Make sure to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at The Stories Cast. And then you can talk to us, ask if you want to come on the podcast, let us know. You can we can get you guesting on. We're going to be taking a little break after this episode, so don't hammer down our doors demanding where the podcast is. We will be back, don't worry. I'm going to get some sweet, sweet content delivered straight to your eardrums. Daryl, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Thank you. It's been
wonderful.
Great.
Well, we'll see you guys in a bit. Keep yourself safe. Much love to you all. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.